Our Planet Money team has been taking some time to find out who might be responsible for the current economic mess. One popular punching bag, the rating agencies, Moody's, Fitch, and Standard & Poor's. They gave AAA ratings to lots of mortgage-backed bonds. AAA was supposed to mean super safe, so investors bought trillions of dollars worth. That money flowed into the housing market, some to subprime borrowers, helping to create the housing bubble. Some critics say if the rating agencies had done their jobs, the global financial crisis might actually have been avoided. Planet Money's David Kestenbaum and Alex Bloomberg have been investigating.
Rating agencies have been around for 100 years. They used to rate railroads.
Today, Alex, they rate everything. IBM, the St. Louis School District, R9, even entire countries.
Standard & Poor's gives Argentina, for example, a B-. The idea is to put a letter grade on the most simple question you can ask. If I loan someone money, buy one of their bonds, am I going to get my money back?
But in the 1990s, new, more complicated kinds of bonds got popular, including mortgage-backed securities. And with these, the rating agencies had to learn a new trick. And that trick was math.
We hired a specialist firm that used a methodology called maximum entropy to generate this equation.
This is Frank Rader. Before 2005, he was in charge of rating mortgages at Standard & Poor's.
There was an actual equation.
Oh, yeah, there's an actual econometric equation.
Did you ever see the equation?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
What did it look like?
It looked like a lot of Greek letters.
The new bonds were based on pools of thousands of mortgages. If you bought one of those bonds, you were basically loaning money to those people for their houses.
The question was, are those people going to make their mortgage payments? That's what this equation tried to put a number on, those messy humans. Tried to predict, based on their credit scores and a bunch of other stuff, how likely they were to be able to make their mortgage payments.
It made sense, Frank Rader says, until loan issuers started offering mortgages to people who didn't have great credit. In some cases, didn't have a job.
These people were new. And so, Dave, let's enter into the record Frank Rader's evidence against his former employer, Standard & Poor's. Rader said there wasn't a lot of data. And when he went to his bosses saying, we need a new model, this is the answer he got.
You've got 94% market share. You're not going to get any more if we build a new model. To them, it was just a tool, and we were making a lot of money with it, so why change it?
Did they say that to you specifically in conversations? Look, we have 94% market share. Like, why do we need a better model?
Yeah. That was a conversation that I had on several occasions.
Standard & Poor's, for the record, says it did update its computer models during the housing boom. And now, witness number two.
They should have just said, you know what? We don't have enough information about this new product to ascribe a rating to it.
That's Jim Finkel. He runs a company called Dynamic Credit, and he helped put together complex bonds called CDOs that had mortgages inside them. He profited from these AAA ratings, but even at the time, they seemed too good to be true.
There were ratings that we saw that made no sense to us.
Did they rate your stuff higher than you thought it should have been rated?
I think we marveled at the ratings that all these CDO products got.
In order for a bond to get a AAA, it was supposed to have passed a particularly strong test. The rating agencies would simulate a worst-case economic storm and put in a sort of financial cushion to protect the highest rated bonds.
But those worst case scenarios were sometimes perplexing to outsiders, like witness number three, Mabel Yu. Mabel Yu analyzed bonds for Vanguard, which manages $400 billion in bond investments. These new deals would land on her desk with their AAA ratings, but she says she could never get a straight answer about what exactly the worst case scenario really was.
I got names of the rating agencies analysts, and I asked them lots of questions. In the beginning, the questions would be 15 minutes to half an hour, but then it turned into hours and many hours. I asked them, okay, AAA is supposed to be minimum risk. That means if the economy goes down, if the housing price go down, if the interest rates go up, people can refinance or, you know, if all of those things happen at the same time, you know, what would happen to our investment? And I could not get a straight answer.
Did they say, look, you worry too much? We have a lot of smart people working on this?
many, 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 many times. I felt so dumb many, many, many times. They asked me, don't worry about it, have a life.
We reached out to the two biggest rating agencies for this story, Moody's and Standard & Poor's. Moody's declined to be interviewed, but Standard & Poor's agreed. If you look back, what was the thing that was missed?
Well, I wouldn't say anything was missed.
This is Tom Warwick, a managing director at Standard & Poor's. He was in the room when those mortgage-backed securities during the boom were given their AAA ratings. He stands by that decision.
Never before in the, you know, in the history of the country, dating back to the Great Depression, have we had the type of nationwide market value declines in home prices, and the associated default levels.
I mean, there are people who would say, you know, these were loans being out to people who didn't even have to prove they had jobs. We had no data on how these loans were going to perform. How could you rate these things?
It's important to understand the riskier we believed the loan was, the more loss reserves needed to be incorporated into the transaction for us to rate a transaction AAA.
But there are people who would say you had no data to know what the real risk of those people defaulting was.
Well, we had lots of data. We had years worth of data as to how borrowers perform over time.
For these loans, for people who didn't have to prove they had a job, you had lots of data for that?
We are able to, through our analytical process, we're able to develop assumptions around what we believe the future will be like for these particular borrowers.
Standard & Poor's says investors also have to do their homework, and some did. After Mabel Yu at Vanguard raised her concerns, Vanguard stopped buying mortgage-related bonds. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg.
And you can hear more on the rating agencies this weekend on Chicago Public Radio's This American Life.
Yesterday, we told you about some Iowa farmers close to retirement who were weathering the recession well. Well, today we go into town, to rural DeWitt, Nebraska. NPR's Howard Berkus introduces us to another side of rural retirement, an unemployed 60-year-old factory worker.
It's just a four-block walk from Randy Badman's house past the grain elevator and railroad tracks to the cavernous metal building on Main Street, where he spent more than three decades at work.
It brings back a lot of memories here, and I remember riding a bicycle and parking it right beside, walking right in and going to work, and then I remember parking a motorcycle there. Planned on retiring here. You know, a lot of us that got laid off did.
The layoff was 4 years ago when Irwin Industrial Tools downsized the plant that had been making vice grip locking pliers in Nebraska since the Great Depression. Vice grips were invented in a blacksmith shop down the street, and the tool brought more jobs to DeWitt than it had people to fill them. The last 300 workers were let go in October when the tool making moved to China. By then, Randy Badman had already found and worked two other manufacturing jobs, and both ended in layoffs.
What have you been doing since?
Looking for another job. And right now, the job market, especially in manufacturing, is extremely difficult to find a job.
How has all this affected your retirement plans?
It changed them, obviously. Some of the plans that you have for retiring, you just have to set them aside because right now, everything is up in the air.
Badman is 60 years old and was hoping to retire in the next 5 years, but his retirement savings are down 40%, and he needs to work just to get to retirement.
You know, to live for 8 months on no income, losing half your income, if you have any kinds of savings, you tend to use those up, you know, and then it happened again to you, you use up what you've got, you get to the point where you don't have anything anymore. And that's kind of a scary feeling.
We talk in a sunny meeting room at the DeWitt Village office where Badman chairs the village board, a job that pays about $92 a month. His wife, Marge, works part-time.
That's why the panic button hasn't been pushed just yet, because she's bringing in some money there also.
Badman was a tool shop supervisor, a skill perfect for the manufacturing plants that provided plenty of work in rural places. But downsizing and shutdowns that preceded the recession continue, says economist Ernie Goss at Creighton University.
Small manufacturers have really been hit hard by this economic downturn, and they have done some outsourcing, moved offshore, moved to other countries, and that's really affecting the rural areas.
The need to continue to work, Goss says, just to get to retirement will force some to leave their hometowns, adding to a tax and brain drain already plaguing rural America.
If every one of those retirees could take a chunk of the infrastructure with them that would not have to be paid for by those who remain, you'd be okay. But you've got schools, the sheriff's department, the county court clerk, all these are affected by this. It's not a small thing.
And it's a concern in DeWitt, Nebraska, where Randy Badman is part of an effort to lure another company.
Right now is a difficult time with the economy. You know, all companies are cutting back.
Badman vows to stay put as long as he can as he searches for work. And he drills screws into new planks in the deck he's replacing behind his house to relieve the stress of a life plan gone awry.
Timing is everything in life, isn't it? Sometimes you have good timing and sometimes you have my timing. And right now my timing's not too good.
Randy Badman still hopes he can retire in DeWitt, Nebraska, where he was born and raised and worked 36 years. Howard Berkus, NPR News.
The story of the Vice Grip tool and its invention in DeWitt, Nebraska is at npr.org, along with other stories in our Rethinking Retirement series. Tomorrow, we'll answer some of your questions about retirement. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. As General Motors begins to restructure under bankruptcy, the company is expressing what it calls 100% confidence in its Corvette line. GM says it will continue to make the iconic sports car. But as NPR's Tovia Smith reports, many Corvette drivers are deeply troubled by the state of the company that makes their beloved macho cars.
Ask a Corvette driver about the GM bankruptcy, and you might actually make a grown man shed a tear or two.
It hurts. You know, I hate to see it happen.
Terry Partridge is president of Massachusetts South Shore Corvette Club.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, welcome to Cruise Night here at Montponson Inn.
A group of guys joined together by their passion and lust for their vets.
I fell in love years ago, basically as a kid. And when you get older, you finally say, you know, before I die, I want to own a Corvette.
Steve Boyajian is the kind of customer who made GM the giant it once was, selling sports cars and dreams to drivers 17 or 70, like Terry Partridge.
It's the feeling you get when you're driving it. You never get old driving this thing. And that's mine, hot one.
Hot one.
Hot one.
With the flames on it.
With the flames on it.
These are guys with way more invested in their cars than the sticker price. John Zofchak says he souped up his vet with a custom paint job, vertical lift doors.
You know, transmission work, body work, brake work, shock work, suspension work. I always do a little customizing to the car, so I'm a part of the car as well.
Who wouldn't want to see themselves in the iconic American hot rod? To guys like Boyajian, the Corvette was always the epitome of pride and power.
No question about it. It all comes from power. That's right. When you step on that thing can respond, smoke the tires, and shoot out of that hole. Oh, yeah, that's definitely something.
Across the lot, Zofchak shows off his sleek yellow 638-horsepower ZR1.
This car is so powerful, it requires my girlfriend to wear a sports bra.
No wonder so many of these guys are having a hard time seeing the once dominant GM, the maker of their ultimate American muscle car, now on its knees.
We can't let General Motors go. That's letting America go if you let General Motors go. I mean, it's a way of life.
Again, Boyajian and Paul Lessigor.
It's an American icon, General Motors. It's like unbelievable to think that, you know, we'd lose them. Forget about it. It's crazy.
Most folks here believe that GM will recover, but what saves the company might also spoil its appeal to folks like Zofchak.
You know, I certainly think that, you know, you're going to see a lot more smaller cars, more efficient cars being built. Is it what people want? No, but it's what they're going to be able to afford. That's the bottom line. You know.
But then people aren't going to have the same relationship with their
car. Absolutely not. It's going to be, a car is going to be nothing more than a piece of transportation. And maybe that's all it should be. Who knows?
It all leaves members of this Corvette club wondering what kind of car clubs their kids will join. As one put it, GM might become more like the Japanese. But 30 years from now, he says, who's going to want to collect Toyota Scions? Tovia Smith, NPR News.
We were just hearing there about Ford, and the Ford Motor Company finds itself in an odd situation these days. Alone among the domestic automakers, Ford has managed to survive without getting billions of dollars from the federal government. That could help Ford win over some new customers. It could also put Ford at a disadvantage. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer has our story.
Harold Ziegler Ford is a relatively small dealership in a rural part of West Michigan. Ted Holloway is the sales manager. He says people out here are starting to take notice that Ford's the only Detroit company surviving on its own.
You know, you do hear it periodically. You know, a customer will come in the door and say, hey, you know what? We're going to look at a Ford only because they didn't take any government money or whatnot. And it's funny to hear, but it's true.
Holloway says so far he's only hearing that from a few customers, though a few customers can make a big difference for a small dealership. But Holloway says he's also seen increased competition, especially from Chrysler. Chrysler dealers have been slashing prices in recent months to cut inventory, and Chrysler dealers that are going out of business are cutting prices even lower. It's tough for Holloway to compete against that.
If somebody's coming in solely on price, and price is the only thing that matters, you know what? There's a good chance they might end up buying a Chrysler.
And while dealers like Holloway have their own problems, Ford as a company has challenges too. It's now up against two competitors that will have tens of billions of dollars of debt wiped out. Ford was able to avoid bankruptcy because it took out more than $23 billion in loans a few years ago. But it has to pay those loans back. GM and Chrysler don't have the same burden. GM and Chrysler also now share a financing division, GMAC, and it got its own help from the government, which could make it easier to finance new car deals, another advantage Ford doesn't have. Talking about these challenges publicly is a bit tricky for Ford, since it supported the government's bailout of GM and Chrysler. Now Ford officials don't want to seem like they're complaining. So you get statements like this.
We understand that, you know, some of what's going on now has the potential, you know, to change the competitive dynamic.
That's Ford spokesman Mark Truby. He says Ford supported the efforts to save GM and Chrysler because they share parts companies, and Ford didn't want to see the parts companies go away. Ford was also concerned about what a GM failure would have done to the overall economy. Now Ford just has to keep up with the changes going on across town.
We're going to continue to work with all the parties to try to ensure that at the end of the day, Ford's, you know, not disadvantaged, because we think if all things being equal, we think we can win with our products.
Product development is one area where Ford may have the upper hand. GM and Chrysler have been forced to cut back on some projects while they work their way through bankruptcy. Independent auto analyst Eric Merkel says that gives Ford the advantage.
I know that seems strange given all the money that the government's dumping into these companies, but at the end of the day, Ford has by far the strongest product pipeline. They certainly have momentum in their favor, and I think they will win a lot of consumers as they move through this relative to GM and Chrysler.
Merkel says Ford will have another advantage. It won't have to operate with Congress and the Treasury Department looking over its shoulder. The company's not wasting any time. Yesterday, Ford announced it would increase production over the summer. That's while GM and Chrysler both plan to have many of their plants closed. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Grand Rapids, Michigan.